Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to begin in the Hollywood section. We've got some Odyssey news to cover. We're going to move to the Royals. We've got some Meghan Markle news. And then, as usual, we'll end with the politics section. First is, you get a car, you get a car. Oprah Winfrey reacts to her own viral career moments, from the car giveaway to the color purple to Meghan Markle. As Winfrey explains to Vanity Fair, her original mission was to let people know that you're not alone. Here, she relives some of the most iconic moments in her career. This is by Savannah Walsh on July 21st. Vanity Fair ain't gonna get me crying in here, I can tell you that right now, Oprah Winfrey says, snapping herself out of an emotional memory as part of Vanity Fair's scene selection. Her steely vow aside, the talk show host-turned-media mogul digs deep while reacting to standout clips from her 40-plus years in the spotlight. One such pop cultural keystone, Winfrey's groundbreaking car giveaway, which happened on September 13th, 2004, during the season 19 premiere of The Oprah Winfrey Show. Winfrey wore a red Celine suit to match the bright big bow that topped each vehicle, one for every member of her studio audience. You get a car, you get a car, everybody gets a car, Winfrey shouted as a way to avoid pandemonium, her voice rising above the screeches of the overjoyed crowd. At the time, she had no idea she had coined a catchphrase. But Winfrey did have a hunch about the staying power of one Barack Obama, a then senator from Illinois where her show was filmed, whose profile got a big boost from his early appearances on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Look at how sweetie pie young he is, Winfrey tells Vanity Fair when watching footage of an Obama appearance on her show. I knew then he was going to be president of the United States. Not only did I know it, I was saying it out loud, she says, recalling how at a dinner party she introduced Obama to high-profile guests, including Coretta Scott King, Sidney Poitier, and Maya Angelou. The future president went on to appear on Winfrey's show multiple times, but that first interview, conducted in October 2006, had high stakes. I was nervous, and I wanted this to be a good platform for him. I wanted people to see what I had seen. Elsewhere in the video, Winfrey sounds off on filming The Color Purple with Steven Spielberg and asking Meghan Markle if she had been silent or silenced during her time as working royal before her and Prince Harry's UK exit. My favorite moment in any interview is when either a person says it out loud, I never thought of it that way before, says Winfrey, or you can see in their eyes something just happened and they never thought of it that way before. That idea is evident in a landmark 2010 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show that saw the host invite 200 male sexual abuse survivors to share their stories while holding photos of themselves at the age of their abuse. They had carried shame. They had blamed themselves, Winfrey recalls. They had never known that there was anybody else who felt the way they did, not to mention 200 men sitting in a room holding pictures of themselves at the age that they were abused. I just thought that that was phenomenal. Winfrey's syndicated talk series, which ended in 2011 after 25 seasons on air, even helped inspire her own catharsis. Being a victim of abuse myself, I know that I was defined by shame for most of my life, says Winfrey. It's actually The Oprah Show that freed me. Doing this show for so many men freed them. She is hopeful that Feeling finds Kristen Cabot, the former chief people officer at the tech company Astronomer, who faced intense online backlash after appearing on the Kiss Cam at a Coldplay concert with her married and then CEO, Andy Byron. Earlier this year, Winfrey conducted a worldwide exclusive interview with Cabot on her podcast, which returned recently for its second season. If you live long enough, you will have a moment where you don't want to get out of bed, says Winfrey, because something has happened that made you feel like you lost yourself or you lost your identity. For Winfrey, now 72, that low point arrived in 1990, the year her half-sister told a story to the National Enquirer that revealed Winfrey had gotten pregnant at 14. And that's the one big secret I had held my whole life, says Winfrey. But life's most harrowing moments are often what brings us together, she adds. To be able to put that in context, I think, is a powerful thing, because I think it offers a sense of our own shared humanity and how we belong to each other, and that there's no story that you've experienced that someone else hasn't already felt, Winfrey adds. So my intention when I started The Oprah Show is to let people know that you're not alone. And at the end of that 25-year run, that is exactly what we did. Our next article in the Hollywood section, Matt Damon struggled through his Odyssey transformation. The actor's physical journey to play Odysseus in the Christopher Nolan film has been the focus of a great deal of attention and praise, including from his co-star Charlize Theron. But credit for the result on the big screen also goes to his stunt double, Devin Dalton. This is by Anna Zucca on July 23rd. This month, Christopher Nolan's highly anticipated The Odyssey hits theaters, and between controversy from purists and praise from film buffs, the epic film is the talk of the town right now. Its protagonist, Odysseus, played by Matt Damon, has also found himself in the spotlight due to the dramatic physical transformation the actor underwent to get into character. But the credit for what we see on screen, the actor recently explained, isn't solely his. As a guest on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast, Matt Damon revealed that his biceps were almost 100% real, but the rest belonged to his stunt double, Devin Dalton. In fact, it was the stunt woman who stood in for Damon during some of the scenes, including the fight with Lastragonians. Armored giants that Nolan made look imposing, not through CGI, but by using clever low-to-high camera angle, the lead actor explains. There were these stuntmen who were all 7 feet, and then they got stuntmen who were under 5 feet, including Dalton, as he explained. My double was a woman, a female stunt performer who had the greatest arms I've ever seen. Praising Dalton's work, Matt Damon added, when she came into the catering tent for the first time I met her, I went up and I hugged her and I thanked her for all the work she'd put in. According to her profile in the Stunts Unlimited directory, Dalton is a stunt woman with a background in dance, specializing in boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai, sword fighting, and the use of weapons on set. Among the actors and actresses whose roles she has taken in action scenes is Millie Bobby Brown. And while Odysseus congratulates his stunt double, his on-set colleagues praise the lead actor's physique. Speaking with Entertainment Tonight, Charlize Theron talked about Damon's incredible appearance. The actress, who plays Calypso on screen, explains, I made this movie with him. I've seen him without all of that suit on. It's weird. I'm like staring at him weirdly. I'm looking at his ass. And then jokingly scolded herself, admitting she shouldn't do that simply because that's just wrong. Damon's physical transformation was indeed one of the most important preliminary aspects of The Odyssey, since Nolan wanted an Odysseus with a lean but defined physique. As a guest on the New Heights podcast, Damon discussed the process. I was in really good shape. I lost a lot of weight. Nolan said he wanted me lean but strong. It's a weird thing. I literally, just because of this other thing I did with my doctor, stopped eating gluten. I used to walk around between 185 and 200 pounds, and I did that whole movie at 167 pounds. I haven't been that light since high school, so it was a lot of training and a really strict diet. Reflecting on the immense physical strain he put his body through, Damon told the Sunday Sit Down podcast that it was a real feat in many ways. The prep and all that I had to do as a guy in his 50s, that was its own challenge. That was my own cross to bear, away from everybody. Recalling his preliminary conversation with Nolan, he revealed that the director had warned him of the difficulties. And I looked at him like, I've made, 80 movies? And he goes, no, this movie's going to be really hard. He, to his credit, was not lying. It was definitely the hardest movie I've ever done, just because it was so ambitious, just because of what he was trying to do. And in related news, I'm sure you've heard Elon Musk's disapproval of the casting. So this article is casting Elon Musk's quote-unquote historically accurate version of The Odyssey. Musk has promised to have his AI model make a historically accurate version of The Odyssey and has expressed a willingness to give Mel Gibson $100 million for another kind of adaptation. Here's what we think a Musk-produced Odyssey could look like. This is by Chris Murphy on July 23rd. Did you know that Elon Musk wasn't a huge fan of Christopher Nolan's adaptation of The Odyssey? Nolan's epic film adaptation of Homer's roughly 2,800-year-old epic poem is a smash hit with audiences and critics alike, earning a whopping $264 million at the global box office in its opening weekend. It had a pricey reported budget of $250 million, as well as both rave reviews and heaps of Oscar buzz. Of course, even something as successful as The Odyssey has its very loud detractors, many of whom are still crashing out online about Nolan's diverse cast, specifically Nolan's decision to cast Lupita Nyong'o, a black woman, as Helen of Troy, and to cast Elliot Page, a trans man, as Sinan. Sigh, just as we predicted. The arguably loudest voice among those crashing out happens to be the world's first trillionaire. Despite having more money than anyone in recorded history, Elon Musk apparently has nothing better to do than to join the keyboard warriors in railing against The Odyssey. Before the film's release, Musk made his distaste for Nolan's cinematic choices public, saying that Nolan had desecrated The Odyssey in order to win Oscars. Now that Musk has ostensibly seen the film, he's doubling down and seemingly putting his endless supply of money where his mouth is. On Tuesday, Musk reported a 3-minute AI-generated Odyssey teaser trailer built by an ex-user using Gronk Imagine, writing, "Before this year ends, Gronk Imagine will make a full-length movie of the Odyssey that is historically accurate and true to the art of Homer." The AI clip features a scene of Odysseus and Calypso, who are played in Nolan's movie by two white actors, Matt Damon and Charlize Theron. In the AI version, they're replaced with computer-generated white actors speaking in vaguely British accents and standing on a cliff outside of a rocky cave. Already we're off to a tough start. If Musk wants a historically accurate rendition of Homer's poems, his words, not mine, shouldn't Calypso, a sea nymph, be closer to a body of water? Strike one. But wait, there's more. This is not the only Odyssey adaptation that Musk has expressed support for on X. According to Forbes, that same day, a different X user went viral when they asked for Musk to give Mel Gibson, the patron saint of canceled men, $100 million to make an Odyssey adaptation with painstakingly historically accurate ships, armor, weapons, and casting, with all dialogue taken straight from the original poem and delivered in Homeric Greek. In true reply guy fashion, Musk responded, "I'm down." So for those counting at home, Musk has now shared interest in the production of not one, but two different Odyssey film adaptations. One AI-generated, the other Gibson-directed, both historically accurate. While it's highly unlikely that either of these two projects will actually come to fruition, it's worth wondering what Musk's historically accurate Odyssey might look like, whether AI-generated or Gibson-directed. Never mind the fact that a historically accurate adaptation of the Odyssey is, in and of itself, a logical fallacy. Homer's nearly 3,000-year-old epic is populated by mythical Greek gods like Zeus, Poseidon, and Athena, as well as imaginary mythical monsters like cyclopes, giants, sirens, and a witch who can turn men into pigs. The opening chyron of Nolan's film acknowledges this. His story takes place in a time of apparent magic. But if you were to take Musk and his cronies at face value, you'd have to believe not only that all of these magical, mythical beings could be found in documented history, but also that Nolan did a piss-poor job of rendering them on screen. Apologies to Bill Irwin's towering and vulnerable performances as the one-eyed Polyphemus. Yes, that was Bill Irwin. If Musk really wanted to make a historically accurate version of the Odyssey, he'd film a guy named Homer wearing a robe and reciting a poem around a fire for hours upon hours. But even that version might not cut the mustard when it comes to historical accuracy. There's a vibrant scholarly debate as to whether Homer was a single person or many people. It's called the Homeric question. Thus, Musk's promise to stay true to the art of Homer is not as simple as he or his followers would like to believe. It's clear that what bothers Musk and company in the most regard to the accuracy of the Odyssey is the diversity of Nolan's cast. There were no black people or trans people in ancient Greek mythology. They furiously type on their crumb-covered keyboards. They're wrong on both accounts. In Greek mythology, Ethiopia was a kingdom often associated with sub-Saharan Africa, and Hermaphroditos, the offspring of Hermes and Aphrodite, quite famously had both male and female characteristics after fusing with the water nymph Salmacis. But I digress. Nevertheless, it seems that in either movie, Musk would be looking for not only a white cisgender cast, but also a Greek cast at that. For what it's worth, some Greek people are actually mad about the Greek actor Erasure in Nolan's version. Thankfully, he's got a bevy of Greek stars available to replace A-listers like Anne Hathaway, Tom Holland, and Zendaya. There's Nia Vardalos, writer and star of My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Given that she's the reigning queen of Greek-themed cinema, it only makes sense that she'd slot in for Hathaway's Queen Penelope. Her king and long-lost husband, Odysseus, could be played by none other than Uncle Jesse, John Stamos. America's sweetheart Jennifer Aniston has Greek origins. Her dad, John Aniston, nay, Yannis Anastakis, was born on the island of Crete. All that time spent shilling smart water would make her a shoo-in for Calypso. Tina Fey, whose mother was born in Piraeus, would make an incredible Circe. Turning men into pigs sounds like something straight out of the Liz Lemon playbook. Other Greeks who could round out the ensemble cast include, but are not limited to, Access Hollywood's Maria Menounos, The Hanover's Zach Galifianakis, and The League's Jason Mantzoukas, who, by the way, played a tech worker of Arab descent on HBO's Enlightened, which didn't seem to bother Musk at the time. The Miami Heat's Giannis Antetokounmpo, born and raised in Athens to Nigerian parents, could play all of the giant Lastragonians. The heads of Musk and company might explode at the concept of intersectionality when it comes to Antetokounmpo, but his NBA nickname is the Greek Freak, and you'd be hard-pressed to find someone taller than the 6'11" power forward. Last, but certainly not least, there's Tilly Norwood, Hollywood's first AI actor. While she isn't necessarily Greek, is she? She is white, isn't she? So I'm pretty sure she can make room in the cast for her as well. Pencil her in for Helen of Troy. Tilly Norwood, a face so algorithmically perfect that it could absolutely launch 1,000 ships. Next in the Hollywood section, how Apple TV overcame a bumpy start and became an Emmy darling. The streamer behind Widow's Bay and Pluribus has become a major player in the prestige TV wars. This is by Rebecca Ford on July 23rd. Apple TV took a big bite out of the Emmy nominations this year, earning 89 in total, which put the streamer only behind HBO Max and Netflix. It's an impressive turn of events for Apple TV, which had mixed results when it launched in 2019. This week on The Little Gold Men, we take a look at how Apple TV has shifted its strategy over the years to cultivate a crop of prestige TV shows that are both audience hits and Emmy darlings, including Shrinking, Pluribus, Slow Horses, Margo's Got Money Troubles, and Widow's Bay. Widow's Bay is the biggest surprise of nomination morning because the new series, which stars Matthew Rhys as a New England mayor trying to boost tourism on his creepy island, debuted late in the season and is a unique genre mashup of horror and comedy. But the show got 19 nominations, the third most of any season of any series. It's also a great example of how Apple TV has transformed its strategy over the years. When it debuted, Apple TV, which back then had a plus sign at the end of its name, trotted out a ton of stars who would be featured in its new shows and films like Jennifer Aniston, Jason Momoa, and Oprah Winfrey. But many of the shows, other than The Morning Show, fell flat with audiences. Over the years, the streamer has instead been focusing on working with creatives who have boundary-pushing concepts, like Ben Stiller's Severance or Seth Rogen's The Studio. The shows may seem like bigger gambles on paper, but when they work, they earn acclaim. These shows These are all shows that are incredibly idiosyncratic and have a really, really strong vision, says Vanity Fair special correspondent Joe Press. They have actors that we recognize, but they're not the biggest stars in the universe, but they have a very strong voice behind them. You can listen to Little Gold Men on VanityFair.com to hear more about how Apple TV has pulled off this feat and what challenges may still lie ahead for the streamer. We are moving on to the royal section. Our first article, Meghan Markle returns to TV for MasterChef Australia appearance. The Duchess of Sussex insisted on being referred to as Meghan during her guest judge stint on the reality competition show. This is by Ilaria Parada on July 26th. After a very long time away from broadcast television, Meghan Markle returned to the small screen Sunday, appearing as a guest judge on MasterChef Australia. The show, which is patterned after the British series that arguably brought Gordon Ramsay to the world's attention, airs on Australia's Network 10. For its 18th season, which kicked off on April 19th, judges Andy Allen, Sophia Levin, Jean-Christophe Novelli, and Fo Ling Yao evaluate dishes prepared by a curated list of chefs with food fame aspirations. Allen, the winner of the show's fourth season, is also the new parent of a son born April 13th. As a result, he took a paternity leave from the show, temporarily opening up a slot on the judging roster. That's where Meghan Markle came in. On Sunday's episode, Poe informed contestants that Allen's seat would be filled by a very special guest. As the Duchess of Sussex entered the room, "Welcome. Do I call you Duchess?" Poe asked. "Oh, call me Meghan," she replied. "Absolutely, yeah." Despite the As Evers founder's casual tone, the challenge was resolutely formal. Markle instructed contestants prepare a dish fit for a duchess with a hand-picked ingredient list likely familiar to fans of With Love, Meghan, including celeriac, citrus, edible flowers, honey, and macadamia nuts. Later in the episode, Markle was surprised by a video call from husband Prince Harry. "What's going on? Have I interrupted something important?" Harry asked as a crew member handed Markle her phone. "Well, we're actually in the middle of tasting all the dishes. We have four incredible cooks here. It's amazing. They're so talented. We wish you were here," Meghan replied. "He's in Canberra right now with the veterans," Markle said in an aside. "I wish you could try this. These dishes are fantastic," she told her husband. "It's really delicious, and there's a hot sauce that, well, you know me, it is so good," she said, before making a statement that suggests Harry will not be sitting down for a Hot Ones interview. "I think it might be too much for you. It's spicy." "Well, go and enjoy it," Harry responded, apparently unwilling to defend his tolerance for spice. "I'm very sorry to disturb you. All is well here. I'll see you later." This call was a confirmation of the show's shooting schedule. Meghan and Harry were only in Australia for 4 days this spring, a trip that began April 14th. While on the continent, the couple also attended the mental health-focused InterEdge Summit, visited the Australian War Memorial, and watched an Invictus Games-related sailing event. Markle also appeared as the keynote speaker at a girls' weekend retreat hosted by Her Best Life, an Australian podcast. Now add that to a MasterChef spin during which Markle sang the praises of the land down under. "Oh, we're so excited," she told the show's contestants of her and Harry's visit. "We love Australia. We had the most sentimental, amazing time. We were here almost 8 years ago. We announced that we were pregnant with Archie at the time, so it's full circle. Here we are, but thrilled to be here with all of you and taste some really good food." In other royal news, Prince George is getting a low-key party but no iPhone for his 13th birthday, sources tell Vanity Fair. Prince William and Kate Middleton are keeping their elder prince off social media as he prepares to fly the coop. This is by Katie Nicholl on July 22nd. On Wednesday, Prince George will celebrate his 13th birthday with a party before he starts at Eton College in September, with the royal also set to enjoy a few more weeks of summer fun. Insiders tell Vanity Fair that the teenage prince will mark the occasion with a low-key party and a homemade cake baked by Kate Middleton. As for gifts, one thing George won't be getting is an iPhone, says Royals commentator Sarah Hewson. His parents are very hot on phones and they won't allow him on social media. They want to protect him from that for as long as they can. Prince William, Princess Kate, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis will be spending much of the rest of the summer at Anmer Hall, their Norfolk hideaway, as they prepare for the teenage prince for the next chapter of his life, starting boarding school at Eton in September. Sources close to the family say they want to make sure they have quality time together and will be keeping things low-key and close-knit before George begins attending Eton. According to one family member, the Waleses are hoping to give George a summer to remember. He starts boarding school in September, and that's a big step. He'll be away from home for the first time, and William and Catherine want to spend as much quality time as they can this summer, the source says. George will be following in his father's footsteps when he enrolls at Eton in September. His uncle, Prince Harry, also attended the prestigious school. Before George begins classes, the family will enjoy Norfolk's wild beaches, its rugged coastline, and taking forest walks. It's very special to the family because it's a place where they can escape daily life and enjoy their freedom. It's their family sanctuary, says Hewson. They go for walks, spend long days jumping into the marshes and running along the beaches. It's a children's book, Swallows and Amazons type summer, the best possible summer before George heads off to boarding school. One more in the royal section, King Charles shows off Buckingham Palace's lavishly decorated and rarely seen Chinese dining room. The monarch welcomed the UK's new prime minister in one of the palace's most opulent rooms. This is by Ben Girardini on July 21st. King Charles welcomed Andy Burnham to Buckingham Palace on Monday before the new prime minister made his way to Downing Street. His Majesty received in audience the Honorable Andrew Burnham, MP, and requested him to form a new administration, Buckingham Palace announced in a statement before confirming the meeting. The Honorable Andrew Burnham, MP, accepted the King's offer and kissed hands upon his appointment as Prime Minister and First Lord of the Treasury. Burnham's wife, Marie France Van Heel, was also in attendance. A handful of photos were released from the audience showing King Charles and Burnham shaking hands. But it is the room in which the meeting took place that caught the eye of many commentators, as it offers a rare glimpse inside one of the most lavish rooms that have been recently renovated in Buckingham Palace. The Chinese dining room is one of the most lavishly decorated rooms in the palace. Formerly known as the Queen's Dining and Lunch Room, it is adorned with a number of furnishings and fittings from King George IV's Brighton Pavilion, salvaged when Queen Victoria sold the pavilion to Brighton Town Council in 1846 to fund the construction of the East Wing. The East Wing was designed by Edward Blore in the 1840s under the guidance of Queen Victoria, who wanted to create more space to entertain guests and relax with her expanding family. The design included the central balcony on the palace's front facade, made famous at royal weddings and Trooping the Colour, which was originally suggested by Prince Albert. Pride of place are the four chinoiserie panels commissioned by George IV and painted by Robert Jones for the pavilion. One of these panels can be seen in the photos of King Charles and Burnham, as can the monumental fireplace, which boasts two ornately carved pillars and a white dragon coiling off its center. Behind the two men is an antique-styled table with dragons decorating the legs, upon which sit two porcelain bird statues and a small pot filled with purple and white flowers. It seems as though the Chinese dining room has been redecorated in the East Wing overhaul that took place at Buckingham Palace between 2019 and 2024. The carpeted floor has a different pattern, for one, and it looks like a number of the pieces have been moved. The palace noted ahead of the renovations that 3,000 pieces from the royal collection were being moved from the Chinese dining room, with some returning to the royal pavilion. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about King Charles welcoming the new prime minister to the Chinese dining room. The wallpaper in many of the rooms was removed due to the possibility of vibrating machinery damaging the delicate paper. As such, wallpaper conservators were drafted in to remove it by hand. Alison McDermott, one of the curators, said it could not have come at a better time, as the pieces are in desperate need of conservation due to their acidity. Other rooms affected included the yellow drawing room and the center room, the latter of which was photographed recently when Queen Camilla hosted a reception in honor of the 75th anniversary of the English National Ballet. As part of the 5-year restoration project, the Kylan clock in the yellow drawing room was dismantled and conserved for the first time in decades. Who knows when state banquets will return to the ornate halls of Buckingham Palace. For now, though, royal watchers can rest easy with glimpses of the monument's most decadent rooms. All right, we are moving to the politics section now. Our first article, Donald Trump holds the White House press corps hostage. As an AI Thomas Jefferson delivered a lecture on the freedom of the press, Trump warned journalists, "When I'm gone, you're all gonna be broke." This is by Aidan McLaughlin on July 25th. It was 10 minutes into President Donald Trump's speech at the White House Correspondents Association dinner on Friday night when the event began to feel like a black tie hostage situation. Trump was speaking at the dinner for the Washington Press for the first time, and despite early signs he would stay on script, the speech soon devolved into a rambling and crass address that left the room uncomfortably silent, guests scrolling on their phones or pushing dessert around their plates. Presidential speeches at these dinners typically run around 20 minutes and follow a formula. The president offers a lighthearted roast of the assembled journalists and ends on a lofty note about the importance of a free press. Donald Trump is not a typical president, of course. He spoke for more than an hour, careening between his preferred topics, including the provenance of ballroom chandeliers and Chris Christie's circumference. "It's hard to escape the feeling that this dinner is more for Trump than the remaining journalists," grumbled one member of the Washington press corps. You had to feel for them. Washington's top journalists, who would rather be on the campaign trail in Maine or in the Hamptons or on the Mediterranean or at the very least on the Eastern Shore, anywhere but here, were already trapped in the nation's capital on a hot summer's night. Now they had been lured by the president to the basement of a hotel he once owned so that he could talk at them about Czech lighting fixtures and Chris Christie fighting Jerry Nadler for a piece of cake. Even the White House efforts to stuff the venue with cabinet members and West Wing aides didn't save Donald Trump from bombing. After he stumbled through the Christie cake riff, the camera cut to Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen, who sat stone-faced. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt had promised the speech would be unifying and vicious. At moments, it was one of those things. Trump attacked Chuck Schumer, using Palestinian as a slur to mock the New York senator. He fixated on CNN anchor Caitlin Collins' looks, instructing her to smile more before delivering a clumsy joke, comparing her to trans influencer Dylan Mulvaney. He said Ilhan Omar should get out of our country. When the camera showed the room, attendees' faces were expressionless or turned down toward their phones. Trump seemed aware he was bombing. He repeatedly asked the impassive crowd who had written his speech. After delivering an incomprehensible joke about a senator having sex with his wife, Trump tried to explain the punchline before asking the audience, "Does anybody get that? I thought that was actually pretty good. That was actually the only thing I thought was good in this whole freaking stupid speech." It may be unfair to blame the speechwriters, a team led by Ross Worthington that back in April had input from roast comic Tony Hinchcliffe. On Friday night, Trump's delivery often appeared to be the problem. He sometimes stopped in the middle of pre-written jokes to riff about his perceived enemies, so much so that by the time he delivered the punchline, it was unclear what the setup was. That kind of extemporaneous grievance association may thrill the MAGA hat-wearing denizens of a Trump rally, but in a room full of journalists, it fell uncomfortably flat. The WHCA has drawn criticism for hosting Trump at the dinner. Days before, a group of 500 journalists, including Ann Curry and Jim Acosta, signed an open letter calling the WHCA to forcefully demonstrate opposition to President Trump's efforts to trample freedom of the press. CBS News senior White House correspondent and WHCA president Weijia Jiang, in an interview with C-SPAN, called the letter disappointing and said it was based on the premise that we weren't going to say anything about the current environment, and that's a false premise. There were thinly veiled efforts throughout the night to impress upon Trump the importance of the press. There was this pointed remark, "The government doesn't get to shut the press up. Not when it's wrong, not when it's annoying, and not when it's asking uncomfortable questions." That was Thomas Jefferson. Well, not really. It was an AI video of Thomas Jefferson that aired in the middle of dinner. The selection of Jefferson to deliver this message was likely no accident. Trump is fond of the third president. His portrait hangs in the Oval Office, framed in gold, and last week Trump installed a bronze statue of Jefferson in the Rose Garden. The video continued hammering the theme. It featured clips of Trump arguing with reporters, including his infamous clash with Jim Acosta. It featured clips of Trump's predecessors, from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush to Barack Obama, extolling the value of journalists that cover the powerful. Ken Burns appeared to point out that Jefferson famously championed a free press. AI Jefferson stepped back in to admonish his predecessor, AI John Adams, for trying to crack down on journalists. AI John Adams looked chastened. It's unclear Trump felt the same. As the room applauded, the president did not appear to be clapping. While the purpose of the video may have been didactic, Zhang tried her hand at flattery. "President Trump, thank you," she said warmly in her introductory remarks. "Thank you for being here again. Thank you for all of your support as we rescheduled this dinner." Recalling the shooting attempt that derailed the original dinner in April, Zhang recalled the night's impromptu briefing at the White House. "Mr. President, you went straight to the podium in the White House briefing room to answer questions from journalists, all of us still in our gowns and tuxedos," she said. "That night will go down in history, and so will our response." During that news conference, President Trump said that ballroom was totally unified and that it was a beautiful thing to see. The stiffest confrontation of the evening came when CNN anchor Wolf Blitzer took the stage to hand out the night's awards. As Trump sat and watched, Blitzer presented honors to journalists who report on his administration, reading out in uncomfortable detail the revelations of their coverage. There was the Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Dossey accepting an award for his relentless probing of the White House. There was the Associated Press correspondent Zeke Miller accepting for reporting on Trump's purge of allegedly disloyal career civil servants at the National Security Council. There was CNN anchor Caitlin Collins accepting for her coverage of Trump's explosive clash with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. And then Blitzer presented an award to reporters from the Wall Street Journal for their investigation of Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Trump quickly filed a $20 billion lawsuit against the Journal, revealing reporter Khadija Safar's home address, Blitzer said. Her family had to be relocated. The Journal was kicked off of Air Force One, but the reporters continued to file revelatory stories. When Blitzer emphasized billion, Trump laughed and shrugged. His grin faded as Blitzer continued with the whole family relocation business. Still, Trump shook hands with the reporters before throwing up his arms in an "aw shucks" flourish and sitting back down. The lawsuit is ongoing. For the last decade, Trump has effectively held the press hostage. Don't cry for the media. It's been a wonderfully profitable relationship, if at times a dangerous one. That strange symbiosis reached its apogee on Friday night. The president, wearing a red Trump 2028 hat, told the press that they should be thanking him. After all, he's been ratings gold for the news networks and subscriptions crack for newspapers and magazines. "When I'm gone, you're all going to be broke. Your business model is going to be finished," the president said. One blessing for Washington's beleaguered press corps may be a dearth of parties surrounding the rescheduled dinner. In April, there were dozens. The press wear down their heels, bouncing from one sponsored cocktail party to the next, making the same small talk over and over until they're hoarse. This time, there was really only one, a Thursday night toast at the British ambassador's residence to Yang. The journalists bobbing in the backyard of the ambassador's mansion to offer an explanation. All the news networks were too broke to throw another round of parties. Our next article in the politics section, Mamdani's Netanyahu video was a calculated move. Insiders explain his strategy to Vanity Fair. As a candidate, the New York mayor pledged to order the arrest of Israel's prime minister if elected. The Mamdani strategist, who says he pushed for that pledge in the first place, now says that the strategy for pivoting out of it was born months ago, before the mayor took office. This is by Jack Holmes on July 24th. Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal, the architect of a horrific genocide against the Palestinian people, the mayor of New York said in a video this week, referring to the Israeli prime minister. He is responsible for the killing of more than 73,000 people, for the maiming of tens of thousands of children. The video address had the visual trappings of a State of the City speech, but Mayor Zoran Mamdani's words went well beyond the city limits. The two-minute video quickly became one of his most viewed posts ever, some feat for a political operator already known for his virality. As of Thursday night, the post had more than 91 million views on X and more than 108 million views on Instagram. He was cheered by fans across the world and blasted by pro-Israel organizations and members of Netanyahu's government. The move may have solidified his status as the most influential American mayor on the international stage since Rudy Giuliani. And it was all for a speech in which Mamdani openly admitted that he was backing off from his own campaign pledge. He could not, as promised, order Netanyahu's arrest on war crime charges when he came to New York. Yet somehow he gained renewed admiration from his supporters and got the issue off his desk, all in one maneuver. However, while it may have looked like Mamdani was forced to react in real time this week, after a New York Times interview resurfaced the question of the proposed arrest's legality, his team had long been planning for how to handle the apparent backpedal, and even how to turn it into an opportunity. Back in December 2024, less than 2 months into his candidacy, a no-name state assemblyman barely registering in the polls joined Mehdi Hassan's show on Zateo and made his declaration. If elected mayor, he would direct the New York Police Department to arrest Netanyahu if he came to the city, executing a warrant issued 11 days earlier by the International Criminal Court that charged the Israeli leader with war crimes and crimes against humanity for his military campaign in Gaza. The United States is not party to the ICC, but Mamdani went there anyway. It was not off-the-cuff stuff. We knew it was going to be asked, and there was some discussion internally, said Andrew Bard Epstein, the communications director and later creative director for Mamdani's mayoral campaign. I certainly was pushing for him to make this arrest declaration. It just wasn't just about the recent news out of the ICC. In the intervening days, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, then an inevitable but still undeclared Democratic mayoral candidate, had announced that he would join Netanyahu's legal defense team at The Hague. So Mamdani weighed in full force during the Zateo interview, and then he was scarcely asked about the issue again until the final weeks of the primary, Epstein says, when he was finally taken seriously by the political establishment, by people in media and local New York City reporters who then, I think, resuscitated that question. And then it mostly disappeared once more until last week when Mamdani sat for an interview with the New York Times. He was again asked whether he would order Netanyahu's arrest if the prime minister came to New York City in September for the United Nations General Assembly, and Mamdani replied that he was in an active conversation with our legal department about whether he had the power to do so. On Tuesday, he released the video making clear that his administration had concluded he did not have that power. By this point, it was nearly 7 months into his term, more than a year after those caustic final days of the Democratic mayoral primary, and 19 months since Mamdani had made his first statement on the issue. During the campaign, it was reasonable to assume that if someone was subject to an ICC arrest warrant and they entered New York, local law enforcement might have a role in facilitating or executing that warrant, a source close to Mamdani tells me. Given that the NYPD regularly cooperates with federal and international law enforcement, it wasn't a crazy idea. The NYPD did not respond to a request for comment, but spokesperson Delaney Kempner told The Times that the NYPD's position is entirely rooted in the law. At the time, Mamdani was an assemblyman without much knowledge of the legal particulars, the source says, and he didn't have the lawyers on hand to assess them, but he was absolutely interested in what his legal limitations and possibilities were. The pledge was never a major feature of Mamdani's campaign, but it did come up during the transition when Netanyahu spoke of visiting New York City after Mamdani became mayor. By that time, I certainly was aware that I was going to be probably impossible to execute, the ICC warrant, Epstein says. I felt a certain responsibility having pushed this idea in the campaign, so he wrote up some ideas for dealing with the problem and circulated them to the team. His core recommendation: conduct a thorough legal analysis, the if and when it finds that the mayor can't do this. Lay out the moral and legal case against Netanyahu and call in the federal government, which does have that authority. Epstein did not join Mamdani's administration and says he wasn't privy to internal deliberations at City Hall, but in the end, his suggested plan was exactly the course Mamdani and his team pursued. The Times now reports that Mamdani had already learned from his lawyers that the arrest wasn't possible before he was asked about it last week. But according to sources who spoke with the paper, he wanted to tell his supporters on his own terms. Believe me, he knew before the question was asked that he didn't have the power, says Paul Vigala, a longtime Democratic political advisor, when I asked for his read on things as an outside observer. I think the guy has enormous talent, he adds. I question his judgment, but golly, is he gifted. That's because it appears the mayor turned a sour moment, admitting publicly that he'd made a campaign promise he could not keep, into a victory, or at least something with its own political momentum. Mamdani's message on Netanyahu has been cheered by commenters by everywhere from Ireland to Egypt and blasted by opponents like Israel's ambassador to the United States, Danny Dannon, who has accused the mayor of spreading blood libel, an apparent reference to medieval anti-Semitic rhetoric that was later harnessed by the Nazis. But for Bagala, a longtime critic of Netanyahu himself, the problem is that the speech was primarily a spectacle. I think he understands the lessons of Donald Trump's success, in that diversion is a superpower. And look, enrolling every child in New York City in childcare, I bet you that's hard, the former Bill Clinton strategist says. Delivering is hard. It's really hard. And it seems to me like he's saying, okay, I can't really deliver on that, at least as quickly as people want, but I can do this. The mayor has launched new free childcare programs for 2- and 3-year-olds in some neighborhoods. It's like your 15-year-old comes down for breakfast and says, guys, I tried weed yesterday. It was great. And all of a sudden, you're not so pissed about the geometry exam. For folks in Mamdani's camp, however, this misses the point. So do interpretations that focus on how this maneuver got the issue off Mamdani's desk and onto that of President Trump, who's already ruled out acting on the ICC warrant. For Mamdani, they say, the directness of his message is the message, at least in part, and the strategy. I think that New Yorkers want two things, the source close to the mayor says. They want somebody who has conviction, and they want somebody who will give them the truth. And I think that was really important for him to say flat out, New York is not a place that welcomes war criminals. It's probably also refreshing for people to hear a political figure speak plainly about what he can't do, Epstein said. Certainly with President Trump, but I think generally with politicians, they're loath to admit the limits of their own power and influence. He levels with constituents about what we are all collectively witnessing in Palestine, and he levels with his constituents about what he is and is not able to do about it. So far, it's not clear how much it will change the calculus for other Democrats, including a New York congressional delegation led by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. I haven't talked to him about the issue. He's been very vocal on the issue, Jeffries said when asked by a reporter Thursday whether he agreed with Mamdani. I continue to maintain the position that, one, we've got to figure out how to move things in a better direction in the Middle East. And for me, that means a safe and secure Israel as a Jewish and democratic state living side by side in peace and prosperity with an independent Palestinian state that provides dignity, self-determination, and respect for the Palestinian people. I don't advise them, Bagala says of Schumer and Jeffries, but if I did, I'd say all good people loathe Netanyahu. And I know it's not really any of our business, but there's nothing wrong with pointing out that he's done enormous damage to a country we love and to an alliance we need. If the Democratic Center is moving on this issue, an April Pew poll found that 52% of Democrats say they had no confidence at all in Netanyahu to do the right thing in world affairs, up from 37% in 2025, there's little evidence so far that party leaders are moving with it. Look, the hope is that if you do something that's morally right, that other people will join you, says the close source close to Mondami. I don't know if the assumption is that courage is going to magically be extended to Kirsten Gillibrand or Chuck Schumer, right? It would, in fact, be unwise to assume that they're going to go out there and be bolder and braver about this than ever before. Both senators' representatives did not respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment on Mamdani's speech. No matter how things go domestically, Mamdani has a victory for now. He's huge in Dublin. Our next article, Bill Maher doesn't like Trump. Fine. But the Democrats? He might actually vote for a Republican. Or so he says. Over eggs and bacon in Beverly Hills, the lifelong liberal explains why his vote is in play and why Israel may decide where he lands. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on July 23rd. We're about 2 minutes into lunch at Beverly Hills Hotel, and Bill Maher is extolling the sartorial virtues of the Third Reich. Making small talk about boycotts of companies associated with bad causes, Maher observes that Hugo Boss supplied uniforms to the ur-villains of the 20th century. Nazi uniforms are awesome, he says with an impish grin. The officers, the leather coat, especially the generals have the red stripe on the side of their pants. They just look sharp. Maher orders his eggs scrambled and his bacon very, very, very crisp. It's 2 p.m., but he tends to rise around noon, so this is actually breakfast at the Beverly Hills Hotel. We order Arnold Palmer's. The conversation moves, probably logically, from Nazis to the red lines of controversial guests he'll sit down to interview. He recently hosted Kevin Spacey on his video podcast, Club Random, for nearly 2 hours. During the conversation, Maher defended the actor, whom Hollywood generally banished after a series of sexual misconduct allegations that Spacey has long denied. We talked about all those things, grabbing dicks, and Maher says, trailing off, oh, that reminds me, it's the 4th of July. I gotta pick up some wieners. I actually do, I have to get hot dogs. Maher has always relished pressing on a taboo until he finds the bruise. He once told my colleague Joe Hagan that he enjoyed the sensation of being Wile E. Coyote having just run off a cliff, because I like to feel like I'm on the edge, he said. You have to get over it to know where it is. These days, there's one taboo flog he's become known for above all others, attacking the American left with mounting fury, even as its members have comprised a significant part of his audience. Maher has spent decades as an increasingly acidic monitor of his homeland's hysterical politics on his HBO show Real Time. Despite what you may have heard from liberals who believe Maher has lost his way, he has not gone MAGA, and his objections to the Republican Party remain extensive and profane. But have lunch with him and it becomes clear what animates him more. Bring up Donald Trump and he'll offer some sanguine analysis, as if his blood has been cooled by the understanding that most of his friends and contemporaries, certainly those picking at Niçoise salads on the sun-dappled patios of Beverly Hills, will agree with him. Ask him about the left and he'll put down a forkful of eggs to castigate the communist and Jew haters he believes are taking over the Democratic Party. Maher's view is that Trump has become less threatening as his second term has progressed, which may surprise those who fear the president is currently at his most powerful and least constrained. The right, at this moment, is less dangerous, Maher says. Trump is a lame duck who can't run again. He reassures me that the Supreme Court and members of the Republican Party have started to push back on Trump's worst impulses. Plainly, he just doesn't get away with everything he wants to. Trump, in Maher's estimation, has by now been reduced to a corrupt sheriff with Tourette's syndrome who wants to clean up the town. One recent defeat for Trump lends support to Marr's theory that Trump's power has waned. Earlier this year, Netflix informed Marr that he would receive a mighty distinction, the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, handed out at the Kennedy Center, the Washington arts institution Trump had subjected to a hostile takeover in his second term. The ceremony, held in late June, was filmed by Netflix and began streaming this week. After The Atlantic reported that Marr would be this year's recipient of the honor, the White House issued a statement calling the report fake news, and Press Secretary Caroline Levin declared unequivocally Bill Marr will not be getting this award. Trump's handpicked leadership at the Kennedy Center, according to a source familiar with internal deliberations, wanted the award to go to a more servile honoree, Fox News host Greg Gutfeld. The award winner must be approved by the center's board. What followed was a high-level round of behind-the-scenes maneuvering. Netflix chief Ted Sarandos personally spoke with Trump on the phone to tell him that Netflix wanted the honor to go to Marr, and Trump relented. Marr said he's not surprised to hear about the intervention when I tell him about it. I like Greg a lot, but he's not really worthy of this place, Marr says. He's not Mark Twain. Trump and Marr have a long, testy history. Trump sued Marr in 2013 after the comic, marking his birther crusade against Barack Obama, challenged him to prove he wasn't the spawn of his mother having sex with an orangutan. The suit failed, with Trump opting to withdraw it, and Marr continuing tormenting Trump from his HBO perch. Last year, Kid Rock organized a dinner between the men at the White House. It went well. Over steaks, Marr presented Trump with a list of 56 insults the president had hurled at him. Trump signed it in Sharpie. But the detente would not last. Marr called Trump gracious when recounting the dinner on his show, but soon returned to criticizing the president on Real Time. Months afterward, Trump denounced the dinner as a waste of time and Marr as a highly overrated lightweight. Marr brushes off this return to form from the president. Game respects game, he said, joking about how Trump added a dozen fresh insults to his list. His ability to come up with new ones is just astounding. Who could come up with 56 different ways of calling somebody an asshole? But Marr took heat for the dinner. Larry David, who has known Marr since he was a young comet trying to make it in New York, skewered the ordeal in a New York Times guest essay titled My Dinner with Adolf. Marr, according to someone who knows him well, has privately asked how David could be so sanctimonious about his dinner with Trump when David's agent, Ari Emanuel, regularly pals it up with Trump, including at the UFC fight at the White House earlier this year. When asked to describe his politics, Marr takes a long pause. Left of center, slightly, but my vote's in play, he says, repeating what has become a common refrain as he publicly floats voting for Marco Rubio or even J.D. Vance in 2028. Unless the Democrats come up with someone who will full-throatedly denounce this Jew-hating, communist-flirting wing of the party. Still, he says he could never call himself a Republican. They're too religious, he says. They're fiscal hypocrites who absolutely hate it when the government spends money it doesn't have, except when they're in office. They don't think racism is a thing, and it still is to a degree. They think climate change is a hoax and the weather girl's tits are real. But might he vote for one? Yes. The next night at the Kennedy Center concert hall, Marr's guests occupied an orchestra box that could have been a real-time green room. There was Caitlin Collins and Woody Harrelson, John Fetterman and his wife Giselle, Whitney Cummings and Stephen A. Smith. The audience lapped up jabs at crazy liberals and Trump's exes alike. In his speech, Marr thanked his haters for keeping him on his toes. Because of you, I never get complacent, he said. I never believed my own press because there wasn't any. He thanked his fans for their continued support through decades of messy American politics. If you ask me what I'm proudest of in my life, he said, it's staying on the air for 33 years without ever pulling a punch. He enjoyed a long-standing ovation. Marr regards the prize as long overdue. I feel like I should have won it 20 years ago, he tells me. I'm a lot more like Mark Twain than a lot of the comedians who have won it. Still, he seems surprised by the warmth of the ovation. There must have been a lot of actual affection, he said. That felt very real. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week, everybody.